And welcome. we have some new people. So what we do here is we take different approaches, but the main approach that we take is of yoga philosophy, based in yoga philosophy. Yoga philosophy is based in Vedic understanding. So Veda, V-E-D-A, means knowledge. The Vedas are books of knowledge dating back different dates, but roughly 3000 BC, and they come from India. Many of you have studied many traditions and or practiced various traditions and spiritual practices or philosophical approaches. So I have done the same. And I have found, of course this is my opinion, that Indian philosophy, Vedic understanding, and yoga practice is the most advanced spiritual culture and spiritual understanding on the planet. Full stop. So why? It's not that we don't draw upon other philosophies and approaches. We do. But why not just go right to the heart of the matter? That's how I look at it. So that's kind of our approach here. When we talk about God, we talk about God in a generic form, God. But we think about God differently. And we think about God more in the forms of Radha and Krishna, or Lakshmi and Vishnu. There's no such thing in Vedic understanding as God without the goddess. There's no such thing as the manifestation of the masculine aspect of God without the feminine. It doesn't happen. So this brings in a whole other world of possibilities, naturally. And it lends balance to the masculine-dominated religious traditions of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, which are top-heavy with male ego, my opinion.
Can I ask you a question? I'm not sure if you know much about
mystical Islam.
Islam. Mm-hmm. What do they say about the goddess energy?
I'm not sure. You know, when I first woke up, had my awakening, one of the first traditions I studied was Sufism. But that was a lot of years ago.
Rumi.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think they recognize a goddess per se. But they would be far more open to the conception of love. You know, and in the writings, a lot more about love and balance comes out, which is not what you typically hear when people are talking about Islam these days. Mm-hmm. You know, they usually want to break something over somebody's head more often than not. Mm-hmm. So it's not a very tolerant approach, but Sufism is the mystical side of Islam.
The little that I know about it looks very similar to the Vedic yogic philosophy, mm-hmm. with their chanting and their prayers and their devotion. Mm-hmm. And their chants are beautiful. They're quite like Vedic chants. And I think the idea is that you chant so much that you kind of spiral into this kind of semi-conscious, higher consciousness.
Well, that's what chanting is for.
Yeah.
Chanting, to repeat the same thing over and over and over again, is meant to achieve various objectives, and one of them is trance. And also, that's why you have with Sufis or with the dervishes, the whirling dervishes who stand in the middle of the, and then they spin, and they got, they're men, but they got these long skirts, and they go outward. So if you would see it from above, it would be exactly like what we're going to meditate on tonight, which is a chakra spinning in motion. That's what we're going to meditate on this evening, coincidentally. But that is a form of trance dance. That is what mantra is for, creating a trance and taking you out of the mundane and lifting you into the sublime. Mantra. Man is Sanskrit, it's mantra. Man is mind. Tra means to cross over. So, mantra enables the mind to cross over from the mundane identification with the physical world, the body, the ego, death, temporal reality, that which has an end, and takes you into the spiritual realm, eternity, knowledge, bliss, beyond suffering. So this can be achieved even in this body, that state of mind. So that's what mantra is for. So we do use mantras. There are many manifestations of God. In fact, there are hundreds of them. There's no just one manifestation of God, because God is unlimited. Even us, I mean, we would only find any one of you or myself in one form at a time. Now, we might find you one day playing tennis. We might find you the next day walking on the beach. We might find you the next day at your work. We might find you the next day in your garden. And so we could ascribe various qualities and pastimes to you, having done these different things, or on top of your horse. But it is all the one form, whereas God can take as many forms as he wants and perform all these different kinds of pastimes, activities, and exhibit various qualities. So we talk about many, many manifestations, pastimes, and qualities of God here, and have done so since the beginning of time. And what we focus on more than anything is Krishna and Radha, because Krishna is God in his male form of love. So the highest manifestation that there is, and you can debate this if you like, is love. It all comes down to love. God is love. Every religion purports to teach love. The final conclusion is love. Well, some don't really say that directly, but most will say that. Love thy neighbor as thyself. So that's really the best wavelength to be on. You can take any subject and think it to death. Or you can take any body and love them to life. So it's better. Yes, we want an intellectual approach in that. If we have religion or philosophy without love, then we have mental speculation. We speculate on what God might be, And we can argue the ins and outs of that forever. If we have emotion or just an emotional approach without a philosophical understanding, then it reduces itself to sentiment. You can see people on TV all the time, these mobs. They're shouting and yelling and waving their arms. If you were to interview one person and say, what's the problem? Most of them wouldn't know. They're just caught up in a frenzy that is a mob frenzy, and they're feeling these powerful emotions of anger, injustice, victimization. I don't know. I'm not saying it isn't. Doesn't have a basis sometimes. But if we don't have logic and philosophy and rationale and understanding and discretion and discrimination, then we are reduced to sentiment and worse, to fanaticism. No good. So we need a balance of the head and the heart. Always, always, always. But the head's not enough and the heart's not enough. But ultimately, we're going to the place of love, wherein the head, strictly speaking, will no longer be required. You know? Sometimes you will meet people, and I've met many, who are extremely well educated. This one's a master's, and this one's the PhD, this one's a double master's, this one's a... I've met triple PhDs. Clients of mine. You know, some people, they're very intelligent. Anyway, I'm not thinking about any one in particular, but sometimes people become sort of full of themselves with all of their education. Because theoretically, they know so much, they've been taught so much, they have all these degrees. Sometimes that can be a real stumbling block. Because the ego becomes so invested by, do you know who I am? Do you know how important I am? Do you know what all the letters behind my name? And as soon as you sort of slip into that frame of mind, you're kind of finished. You're cooked. Because then you're closed. You're closed down. And you're not open to learning. If you're shut down, you can't learn. If you think you know everything, you can't learn. How will you learn? And learning always requires humility. You have to be humble in order to learn. Or you could be sitting in a classroom, you'll never learn a thing if you sit there with an attitude that it does not consist of humility. So sometimes it's actually a liability to have these levels of education if they serve only to boost the ego. Kalindi and I, we were in San Diego, and we went on this wonderful tour of a tourmaline mine. And in this mine was produced primarily green and pink tourmaline. And the man giving the tour was a really amazing guy. His name was Blue Shepherd, this American guy. He owned the mine. And he'd been in the mining business for, I don't know, 40 years, 30, 40 years, something like that. But a really tuned in guy. So the mine had been shut down during the Second World War. No, this is earlier, I think.
It used to be the main mine for the Chinese empress she bought all the pink tourmaline that was mined to ship back to Kuan Yin.
Yeah.
Give to Kuan Yin.
Kuan Yin's
mine.
The goddess of compassion in Chinese thought. Her stone is pink tourmaline. So the pink tourmaline back then, this we're talking about late 1800s. Somewhere in there. the Americans didn't want the pink tourmaline in the mine. They didn't see any real need for it. They were mining something else entirely. What were they mining? Do you remember? Well, it wasn't tourmaline. And the Chinese immigrants were the miners. Chinese did a lot back then. Built the whole railway system. You know, it was akin to slave labor. So the Chinese were given permission to mine the tourmaline in their spare time, when at the end of the day when the job was done. And for them, this tourmaline mining was being purchased by the Empress of China for goddess Kuan Yin and for Kuan Yin's purpose. And they would even sew pieces of tourmaline all throughout the Empress's garment, because she was the manifestation of the goddess of mercy on earth. I mean, just beautiful conception. So anyway, it got shut down when the Chinese threw the British out of China. You know, the British, they tend to overstay their welcome. The Irish would be familiar with this statement. So what happened was the mine had been shut down for many years. Many years. So this guy, Blue Shepherd, he went into the mine, he acquired the mine, went into the mine, and realized that the Chinese were, you know, everything had been shut down in such a hurry and boarded up by the Chinese that they still had some of their old cooking utensils in, and from years and years and years ago. You know, when they make their rice and their vegetables, and, you know, it was interesting. Sorry. But anyway, he had to figure out a way to mine to find the tourmaline in the rock and to extract it from the rock without destroying these deposits of tourmaline while trying to find it. You understand?
They grow in pockets. So if you can imagine that this mine is the size of the sugarloaf, and you don't know where to start digging into it, and if you do start digging in, because tourmaline, there'll be a hole, a gap, and they'll grow in like this.
Almost like a geode inside, like a geode.
Yeah, that's how they grow. So if you were to go in and just start smashing out each of these
pockets,
it'd be worth $2 million.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was millions and millions of dollars worth of tourmaline in there.
Okay, I've never heard of tourmaline, so I thought it was rock, because what is it?
It's pink crystalline formation.
Crystalline formation.
Yeah, but there's also green, there's also blue, there's many colors, correct?
So where is this one, in America?
Yeah, it's in Temecula, right near San Diego, in California.
So he shipped it all back over to San Diego?
No, the mine's in San Diego. No.
I'm confused.
The Chinese
were working there, and they shipped it to China.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Chinese workers.
But whatever they were, the primary mining, they didn't know that this tourmaline was worth anything.
Well, back then, it wasn't. Nobody wanted it. The only people that wanted it were the Chinese were going crazy. So they were selling it to the Chinese for next to nothing. And the Empress of China was buying all of it. And no one else wanted it anyway, so they probably gave a good price. And for the Chinese workers, the immigrants, this was the greatest service they could possibly do, because they were serving the Empress, who is goddess on earth, and serving Kuan Yin, who is goddess in heaven. Correct? All right. Now, so Mr. Shepherd, he's trying to figure out a way to recognize the rock. So he goes into this cavern, round, big round cavern. And he stood there in the middle of this round cavern for the entire day, from morning till long after dark. And he meditated, asking the tourmaline, more or less, to show him where it's hiding. How can I find you without destroying you? by the end of the day, he figured out how. And these things were called, those, they were shaped like this, like a triangle starts wide at the top and goes down narrow at the bottom, and then there'd be a space between, and then there'd be another one of these. They called them chimneys.
Exactly like the curtains.
Mm. Like the curtains here.
Mm.
6 foot gap. Chimney. And then another chimney.
And
the tourmaline was in the chimney. Right? Well, he thought it was. So, one of the things he did, and anyway, it was revealed to him. One of the first things he did, he called in the geological experts in the mining industry in America at the time, and had like 4 or 5 guys come and presented this theory because it was unheard of. And one of the guys, one of the doctors, he went nuts. This is preposterous. This could never be. Where are you getting this idea? This is nonsense. And he turned around and he stormed out of the mine.
What did he think was nonsense? The fact that there was the rock?
That such a thing would exist as this chimney concept of his, right? So that's just the point of the story. This guy was so puffed up by what he knew or thought he knew that he rejected it outright without even, okay, now let's go test it. Let's either open this up, blast it, drill it, whatever we're going to do. So let's put your theory to the test. This guy stormed out long gone. Last we heard of him. Then they went ahead and put the theory to the test, the rest of them, and discovered that inside these chimneys was this pink tourmaline and green tourmaline, and millions of dollars worth were in there.
But did they think that it was tourmaline inside from the...
Well, that's what he was, at that stage, many years, you know, hints from earlier, that's what they were looking for.
Right.
Because as time goes by, humans want certain things. What you don't want now, you may want later. What is not popular then may be very popular now.
It's almost lost in time, you know what I mean? It was just old word in the valley that there used to be a mine up there.
Yeah.
So mine, he just took a chance.
Did he go looking for it?
Well, they knew where the mine was. They knew where the mine was. And he's, you know, he's a geology guy. I mean, he's in the business.
Oh, my gosh.
So... I sort of went off on a tangent here, but it's a good story.
Yeah.
And but I'm just, the whole point is,
you look what was revealed to him now, just from sitting down and meditating.
Yeah, and this guy was a really tuned in guy. No, real spiritual guy. Yeah. You know, exactly. The, if you like, the nature spirits, the spirit of the mind, revealed its mysteries to him. And he also said that minds, are they always feminine?
Yeah.
They're regarded as feminine. Why? Because they're caverns. They're, yeah. And they all have a personality.
And the miners' wives are never allowed to go in.
The wives are never allowed to go in. The miners are all men. Mm-hmm. Wives never, in case she gets jealous. That you have another girl other than our girl,
yeah,
who's delivering the jewels.
So the female jealousy actually is...
Well, it's yeah. But each mine has a disposition, a personality. And some mines kill. Mm. And people will get killed. Yeah. And if that happens, they will get killed over and over again. This particular mine, no one had ever been killed. Maybe because so much had been offered to the goddess in the past by the Chinese. everything you do, everything you say, everything you create, everything you consume must always first be offered to God. Always.
I never think of offering, I always just say thank you.
That's fun. Well, thank you is... thank you is the bare minimum that you want to do, but you can say, I want you to enjoy this first, and now that you've enjoyed it, I'll enjoy what remains. And that's how bhakti yoga works, the yoga of love and devotion, is that everything is offered first. So that, in that way, it's not done for the ego. Ego, ego, ego. Anything done for the ego has a, for every action there is a reaction. Karma. It could be a good reaction, it could be a bad reaction, it could be somewhere in the middle. It's a reaction. And you must suffer or enjoy that reaction in future. Wow, no problem. We'll give you another body. And you can come back again and again and again. And enjoy and suffer and bounce off the walls and have a karmic fest. Yeah. The only way you can get out of karma, good karma means you got to come back to the world of repeated birth and death also. So the only way you can get off this wheel or cycle of samsara is to not generate any more karma. So the yogi, the gyani or the yogi, that yogi is somebody who's like practicing Ashtanga yoga, or the gyani means somebody who's practicing the accumulation of knowledge. So they may say, good, I will no longer be a karmi, meaning I won't be a fruitive worker. I'm just going to sit right here and I won't generate any karma because I'm not going to do anything. So that in India, you know, you'll meet guys like that, and what you don't know is whether it's legitimate renunciate or a lazy ass. It's not always easy to tell. So it's very difficult to sit and not do something. In the Bhagavad Gita, which we're going to talk about, Krishna tells Arjuna that everybody must act in order to sustain life. You must act even in a minimal manner. So, and in that way, karma will be generated. So how do you not generate karma? Well, you can continue acting, continue working, continue to do whatever it is you do according to your nature, your dharma, but you offer it to God. And in offering it to God, the karma is removed. Because then it is done from the soul, from the spirit, not from the ego. Right? So it's when you do a good deed for somebody, whenever you do something nice and you don't really need recognition. This is not exactly what I've just said. This is not an exact example. But this is sort of the idea. When you do things and you want recognition, That's ego. When you do things quietly, silently, privately, anonymously, and you don't seek recognition, that's as close to non-ego as you'll get. Right? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But you'll still generate karma, even though you're doing it anonymously, quietly, privately, humbly. You'll still generate some karma, unless you first offer it to God. So saying thank you acknowledges that God gave it to you. So, good. I thought we'd talk about the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita today. And Kalindi, in her studies, came up with this really interesting tantric mantra that we've handed out to you. And we're going to do that. We're going to chant that a little bit later. And we're going to meditate on that mantra today. And it's Vishnu's chakra. So we'll get to that. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, Science of Yoga, it's a conversation between Krishna, God, who came down to the earth 5,000 years ago, and Arjuna, his friend, the warrior whose kingdom had been usurped by his crooked cousins, or relatives. And Arjuna said, and there was a battle. They tried everything to avoid this battle. They tried diplomacy of various kinds. Nothing worked. So now they were on the battlefield, the two armies arrayed opposite each other. And Arjuna was known as the greatest archer in the world at that time. So, pardon me. Krishna was driving his chariot, which was really a good thing for him. So anyway, Arjuna looks and sees all his relatives opposite, and he says, "That's it, Krishna, I'm not fighting." Dropped his bow, dropped his arrows. No, this is not it. I can't fight. Can't kill. My grandfather's there. My teacher's there. My cousins, my uncles, these persons, these older, venerated persons. Can't do it. I think I'll just go to the forest and become a monk. And Krishna's going, yeah, you, a monk. He's a warrior, you know. He lives in a palace. You know, he's got probably more than one wife. And God knows they won't be happy about his becoming a monk. Anyway, so Krishna speaks to him the science of yoga. That's the Bhagavad Gita. That's what it is. So in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in the throes, right in the middle of this conversation, it's all in Sanskrit, Arjuna says, "Which is considered to be most perfect? Those who are properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested?" So there is a conception, an Eastern conception, Buddhist conception, a little bit Buddhist, that God is only energy, unmanifest, just divine energy. In Christianity, we call it the Holy Spirit, Holy Ghost. This is a very popular conception. Is it a legitimate conception? Yes. Can you realize God in the energetic form? Absolutely. Can be done. So Arjuna is wondering, well, would it be better for me just to realize the impersonal conception, this energetic form of God, or would it be better for me to serve God through devotional service, loving service, service that is motivated by love? All right? And the Blessed Lord said, he whose mind is fixed on my personal form, always engaged in worshiping me with great and transcendental faith, he is considered, or she, to be the most perfect. So, on the face of it, what's the difference? Well, you can just merge into the energetic manifestation of God's energy. I am God, you're God, this is God, that's God, where everything's God. And in that state, you will lose your identity. There will be no identity. There's no individuality. It's just like merging into the ocean. It's like water merging into the ocean. Or you can go into a relationship with God where you maintain your identity, your individuality, and you reciprocate with God. Just like we reciprocate with each other down here in the material world in various kinds of relationships. How many kinds of relationships are there? All kinds. Many, many kinds. Right? So here he says, I don't think the unmanifest thing is the best. I think that you should enter into relationship with me. And then Krishna goes on, he says, but those who fully worship the unmanifest or energetic or Brahman, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, fixed, and immovable, impersonal conception of the absolute truth. By controlling, how do you do this? How do you realize this level of Godhead? By controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone. Such persons engaged in the welfare of all at last achieve me. So if you are inclined at this point in time to merge into the energy of God, into the impersonal manifestation of God, sooner or later you'll end up in this reciprocation or relationship anyway. Okay. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested impersonal energetic feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. So he said, it's more troublesome, it's harder to take that path. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. Why? Correct. If we go into meditation and we, nothing you saying you can't do this, you can, and it's valid. But what you're trying to do is sort of negate everything, block everything out, negate everything, and negate even who you are until you can go into a transcendent place. Of course you can do this. But that's harder than thinking about God as a person and entering into a relationship. That's much easier. Because then you don't have to negate everything. And certainly, you don't have to negate yourself either. Your own identity. So that's the point. For one who worships me, giving up all his activities unto me, being devoted to me without deviation. You know, you can't be devoted to God one day, sex the next, eating the next, gambling the next, whatever it might be, you know, without deviation. Engaged in devotional service and always meditating upon me, who has fixed his mind upon me, O son of Pritha. For him I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. How do you fix your mind on God? You know, like, I'm busy. Yeah, I have a lot of things to do. I got a full schedule. How am I going to fix my mind on God? You know? Well, you don't have to sit there and fix your mind on God. You just simply have to have a sense of a connection to the divine. And that all of this is coming about because of God's ultimate will. And everything happens by the will of God. So everything, everybody, no matter what takes place, is actually on some level a manifestation of God, or the underlying thing. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. You can't wear your pearls. I can't chant on my pearl mala without the thread. And the thread is God. So, it's not that you have to pray constantly all day long, which might be impractical. It's just that you have a sense that, oh yeah, this is all connected. This is resting on that. This material energy is resting on the spiritual energy, without which the material energy couldn't sustain. What is death? It's when the spirit inside the body that animates the body goes, leads. Excuse me, I'm checking out. Can I have my bill, please? And the spirit leaves the body. And the body goes, what's the difference? You open up that body, you'll find all the organs, you find all the parts. You'll recognize all the markings on the body, all the things that were dear to you when you knew that person. But they're gone. Spirit is gone. So it's to recognize spirit. We're talking about the little spirits that we are, but then the big spirit. That is the glue that holds it all together. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus, you will live with me always. There is no doubt. There is no doubt. In other words, if you take two steps toward God, he'll take 20 to you. My dear Arjuna, a winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me with now, here we go. We're getting to the crux of this chapter. The argument is, you know, I'm busy. I can't think of you all day long. I can't sit there. I can't sit in a lotus posture. I can't even sit in a lotus posture to begin with. What to speak of all day long? Not practical. What should I do? I still want to become God conscious. My dear Arjuna, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulated principles of bhakti yoga, and in this way you will develop a desire to attain me. Bhakti means devotion. Love and devotion. Develop love and devotion for God. When you go into relationship with somebody, maybe not a working relationship, but you could too, even at your job. Sometimes you'll meet people at your work and you hit it off. And then it is more than a business relationship. It can become a very warm, friendly, and even loving relationship. People search for what? Everywhere. Love. Everybody's looking for one thing and one thing only. That is love. Where are they looking for it? Everywhere. When? 24/7. The more people that you have a loving, reciprocal relationship with, I guarantee you, the happier you are. This does not mean an intimate sexual relationship. This means a loving, reciprocal relationship where love, friendship, compassion, understanding, joy, consideration is exchanged between two people. That's what everybody wants. If you're missing anything in your life, my friends, it's love. And if you don't know it's love, if you then find love and insert love into the equation, you will not feel like you're missing anything. It's that simple. Okay. Krishna says, if you cannot practice the regulations of bhakti yoga, oh no, it's too hard, I can't do it. Too much for me. If you cannot practice the regulations of bhakti yoga, then just try to work for me. Because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage. Okay, you don't feel any love for me at all. You can't be bothered. Well, then just work for me. Do your work for my satisfaction. Do that. Offer it up to me. No, I can't do that. That's too much. You know, I'm sidetracked. Krishna says, well, if, however, you're unable to work in this consciousness, then try to act by giving up all the results of your work and try to be self-situated. Right. With the results of my work. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it means to be unattached to the results. Or it means, yeah, you give up the hard-earned results. Or you give something. Yeah. You know, that's what happens when you go to the church on Sunday and they pass the collection plate around.
It's even paying bills to the offers.
Yeah. Everything you do. You just...
You think I have to pay my bills on time?
Well,
I know. I'm
you're glad to do.
I'm just... I love to do.
I'm sure.
Can I ask
yeah.
question?
Yeah.
What about people who give love very easy? Is there something wrong with that?
In what sense?
In the sense, like, you know the thing, give up the love and, you know, I mean, some people, you're saying everybody needs love and we all need love and love is great and of course they do. But I'm going through life and I see lots of people that I don't think want love or feel they need it.
They're blocked.
Yeah.
They're blocked. They're blocked, yeah.
This meant...
Like, don't touch me.
Yeah,
not even in a tactile sense, but just like that these people are going and doing and nothing's happening. And
well, they're disconnected.
Okay.
They switched off. It was beaten out of them. I don't know.
I'm talking about love all the time. And
now, when I say love, I don't mean...
Yeah, I know. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we don't mean there's back in the 60s, there was a lot of this going on in the 60s. Peace, love, dove, you know. So that is kind of ungrounded love. You know, it may be love. A lot of times it was a lot of vacancy, you know. Okay, so... Then he says, okay, maybe you can't do that. If you cannot take to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge. Better than knowledge, however, is meditation. Better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action. For by such renunciation, one can attain peace of mind. See, what this means, give up the results, it means don't be attached to the results. Don't rise and fall with your fortunes. Not easy to do. You watch these game shows. They get people on there. It's a certain breed of people that are the contestants on these game shows. And they absolutely go ballistic. You know. And, of course, the producers want them to behave this way. They call it good TV. I call it a form of madness. So, you know, high highs beget low lows. Manic depression is quite common these days. You know. So we don't want mania and we don't want depression. So we become detached. We accept things as they are. No matter how great your victories are, celebrate them quietly. And no matter how terrible your defeats are, shake them off as quickly as possible. Catherine.
Yeah, I find because like I got a check last week and I haven't paid to the house.
Very good.
2 months. And it was just like, I was so happy and I was like, oh my God, the money's going to all go and I'm going to be so sad again.
So, you know, it hadn't even happened yet. And she's...
Like be stable in the
dry ice.
Yeah. Well, that's what you need to practice.
Meditation.
Detachment, not being affected. Yeah, it's going to come. It's going to go. It's going to come. It's going to go. And when is that going to stop?
Never. When she goes to work.
Even then, it'll come and go.
Wasn't it Buddha that says the root of all evil is attachment?
Yeah. Correct. For by such renunciation one attains peace of mind. Krishna continued, one who is non-envious but who is a kind friend to all living entities, not just people, who does not think himself a proprietor, or as we like to say, it's my field, who is free from false ego and equal both in happiness and distress, who is always satisfied and engaged in devotional service with determination, and whose mind and intelligence are in agreement with the mind and intelligence of God. He is very dear to me, or she. He for whom no one is put into difficulty, who is not disturbed by anxiety, who is steady in happiness and distress, he is very dear to me. One who is devoted and who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without care, free from all pains, and who does not strive for some particular result is very dear to me. Oh my God, I can get in trouble with that one. This is going to undo modern civilization if they take this one to heart. You know that's true. Who's not dependent on the ordinary course of activities. If you become a spiritual person or dedicated to spiritual practice, no offense, you will become less and less like them, those people. You will have less and less in common with them. And you will sit there scratching your head and wondering why you don't want to hear from those people anymore. And you try and you see when they call, oh my God, I'm not going to answer that. I don't want to talk to her. because I know exactly what she's going to say. And she's going to drain me for the next half an hour. And I don't want to go there anymore. The ordinary course of activities that everybody's pursuing, which will lead them to the grave, and which will guarantee them another birth. God bless them. That's the ordinary course of activities. If you want to be on that wheel, then of course you can stay on the wheel. But if you don't, then you will be less and less like people following the ordinary course of activities.
I'm just going to throw spanner in the works because basically, is it not my ego that wants me off the karma field of life anyway?
No, it's your soul.
It's my ego.
No, it's not your ego. Your ego wants always to hang on to its power and control.
Yeah,
to get you off the ordinary course of life, the ego must, in the process of that, give up its power and control.
Yeah, but I would feel that I'm gaining from it because I'm giving up the misery.
But that's not how the ego looks at it. She's asking if it's the product of the ego. It's not.
What would you call it then? Because
it's the product of the self, the true self, capital S.
But is there not some ego there?
It is if you think, no, see how advanced I am now? I'm beyond all these people. I'm so advanced. I'm so spiritual, I can't stand it. That's ego.
That's ego.
It's a big difference.
But if you're saying, in one sense, you don't want to take the phone call from that person because they're going to change the mindset of you or whatever, that is also recognition that you are spiritually more advanced than they are. When is it your ego? When is it not your ego?
Okay. Let me answer that. Let me answer. You have to exercise discretion and discrimination. Okay? There are only so many hours in the day. There are only so many things you can do. There are only so many people you can interact with. Okay? In an exchange with people, when two people come together and then go apart, that's an exchange. One of three things happens. I go into the bar. There's a clerk behind the counter. I might buy some gasoline. I'll buy a newspaper. I say thank you. He says you're welcome. We make change and off we go. That's a neutral exchange. Not positive, not negative. It's fine. Okay. Positive exchange means there's an exchange of energy. This person's getting something. I'm getting something in return. Does it always have to be like that? No. I'm sitting here right now giving. Hopefully you're getting something. I'm not getting directly speaking a return. That doesn't matter. I'm happy to give. Right? If you're in a relationship with somebody who's constantly sucking your energy, draining you, taking from you, and you're happy to give to them, no problem. No problem. But if one day you wake up and you go, enough. I can't handle it anymore. It's not worth it. What am I getting out of this? Maybe you're even getting torment. I don't know. And you say, I choose not to participate in that anymore. That's not ego. That's discretion. You have to make value judgments. Okay. Tonight at midnight, I am not going to go to Ballymun and hang out. That's discretion. What are you saying? You don't like the people in Ballymun? No, what I'm saying is, it's not. There may be danger there for me. I don't know. So I'm just not going to go. Is that my ego? What am I? I'm saying I'm better than they are?
No.
No, I'm just exercising discretion. I'm making a discriminative choice. But you also won't find me in the pub at midnight. And there's, I'm sure, many nice pubs around here. It's not ego. It's a choice.
No, I know it's not ego. I know it's not a choice. But there is also, you know, recognizing, like, your friends that you can sit down with and have this conversation with. And the ones that would just go up their head, or they'd kind of be like, what are you on about?
But you have to be selected. That's been selected.
That's what we're talking about.
No, I do know that that is selective. Mm. And I do know,
you know. No, you don't have to reject anybody.
No, I'm not saying about rejecting anyone either. I'm saying that once you make that, you can differentiate between people, you are recognizing yourself as being on a higher conscious level.
Different.
Different conscious level.
Yeah.
It's very hard not to have an ego thrown in there.
Well, that's...
I'm not saying...
If it's hard not to have your ego thrown in, then that means you're on the neophyte stage of spiritual advancement.
What you're saying is ego. You know what I mean? Not...
Well, if you think you're better than them, then that's ego.
Yeah. Okay, but what if you don't think that you're better than them, but you recognize that you're on a different level of consciousness?
That's discretion.
You just leave it. It's like, you know, everyone could benefit from doing yoga, but you don't go out onto the street and drag everyone in by the hair and make them do yoga. So you let them do their own thing.
Yeah.
And when they're ready, they'll come into your yoga studio. Yeah.
Now, you may have friends that they're not on a spiritual wavelength. That's fine. I have friends that are not necessarily on a spiritual wavelength. I had a friend in Seattle who was my friend for many years. He was an attorney. And I never had one spiritual conversation with the guy. I still liked him. We used to watch football on television together on Sunday afternoon. Him, my son, and me. It's fine. You know. So all I'm saying is, a lot of times I hear from my clients that, I'm changing, and the same group of friends and acquaintances, I don't want to take their calls. I don't want to talk about those subjects. I don't want to deal with their problems. Okay. So you think about it, because I want to move on here.
No, I do. I know exactly what you're saying. I just also... I'm just unsure that all of the ego is bad. Do you know what I mean? Is it all?
Oh, ego is all bad.
Is it all bad?
Yeah, ego is.
Because it's hard to.
Like, discretion is not all bad.
I understand everything that you say, but my head. It's not that it doesn't understand it. It's just there. It's just.
True.
Meditation.
May I?
Yeah.
Paul is my name.
Carry it.
My understanding of ego is anything in yourself that makes you feel either superior or inferior to another human being.
Correct.
And inferior as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you have somebody, I don't know, a pop star or something like that, and you meet them and you go, oh my God, you're so much better than me. That's negative ego. And then the worst, for me personally, the worst negative ego is the ego that tries to defeat myself inwardly. The ego that's in conflict with who I truly am. So that's my understanding of ego. Any part of me that makes me feel superior or inferior to another human being or to myself.
Correct. That's it. Okay, there's another point in this verse. And who does not strive for some result, we are taught. We are taught to strive for some result.
Yeah.
And if you don't strive for some result, you are a lazy ass.
And you have to sit and listen to conversations about, why do you do this?
Yeah. But you see, the highest stage is not striving for some result. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you not to strive for some result.
Because the higher stage is already...
The higher stage is, it doesn't matter. It's not that important. But, at the same time, you will read in other places in the Bhagavad Gita that you should do your duty. Do your duty. Do the thing that is in harmony with your nature. Make some contribution to the world around you. That should be done. But what the result is, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get rich. That's striving for some result. Why don't you just do it and don't worry about getting rich?
Are we all three verses ago about jhana yoga, the yoga of knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge. Yeah.
Is that what we're doing here? Is this jhana yoga?
Well, what we're doing right now in discussing philosophy is jhana yoga, but we're doing it within the confines of bhakti yoga. Okay. One who neither grasps pleasure or grief, who neither laments nor desires, and who renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things, is very dear to me. One who is equal to friends and enemies, who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, who is steady in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who is always free from contamination, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge and engaged in loving devotional service, is very dear to me. Pretty high standard. He who follows this imperishable path of bhakti or devotional service and who completely engages himself with faith, making me the supreme goal, is very, very dear to me. So that is the 12th chapter. So we need not worry if we're not on that level. We need not worry. We take a step or two steps. That's all. Don't worry about it. This shows you where ultimately one can or should go in spiritual practice. It gives you a roadmap. So I like this chapter because there's no hellfire and brimstone. Do this or you'll go to hell. There's none of that. And you say, oh, God, come on. That's too hard. Okay, then don't do that. Do this. Yeah, but I don't want to do it. Okay, then don't do that. Do this. There's always another way, Figure out some way that you can make some offering. Give your heart. Give your love, give a little service, offer a flower. Patram pushpam phalam toyam yo me bhaktiya prayachati tadaham bhakti paritam ashnami prayatatmana. If one offers with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. That's what Krishna said. Can you not do that? The first thing we do when you bring your flowers, and we're very grateful, is we offer them. We snip them, put them in water. We offer them to God. They're not our flowers. They're the flowers of the God and the Goddess. That's His flowers they are. You don't smell them till after you offer.
You're going to get me right.
When you have a loved one, you tend to offer them first. Here's your bite. You have a bite. You smell this first. Here, you try it first. You go first. Don't we do that? That's natural. That's loving. And it makes you happy that you're having your loved one go first. That's a reward in itself. Same idea. Just because God's not standing in front of you, it doesn't mean He's not accepting it. He is. And you keep doing that, one day He will actually be standing in front of you. And you'll see Him. Guaranteed. The reason we can't see God is because we're not pure enough. We're vibrating on too low a level. Our vibration is too dense. It's too gross. It's too covered over. Hello, vibration. God doesn't vibrate down there. So we have to raise our vibration. Molecules vibrate always. And when you raise your vibration, you will go into subtler and subtler realms and dimensions of perception. Yeah. Some people can see leprechauns, nature spirits, and fairies. And some people can talk to them. Some can't. This is Ireland. Lots of people can do it here. There's lots of people here away with the fairies. But I mean that in a good sense. Right? Okay. Now, let us look at this mantra. What is a bija mantra? Bija. We've done bija mantras before. Seed. Seed mantras. So this particular mantra here is a series of seed mantras. A seed mantra is just like you think a seed is. A seed contains in it the potential for the full manifestation. If I have the seed of an oak, or what did we have for the oaks, honey?
Acorns.
Acorns. We look at a little acorn. Is there an oak tree inside there?
Yeah, potential.
There is, right? In the right circumstance, and 150 years hence, we'll have ourselves a nice oak tree, like that one out there. So, a seed mantra, rather than a big, full explanation or fully worded mantra, the seed will have all of that in one sound. That's the concept. Right? So, Vishnu is God, according to Vedic understanding. It's one of the names of God. It's just God. As you say, it's God. This is God. But Vishnu means God who is all-pervasive. God who is everywhere. That's what Vishnu means. So even in the Christian conception, God is supposed to be omnipresent. He's everywhere. So that is Vishnu up there in the altar in the center. You see him there. And Vishnu is in his four-armed form. When he's in his two-armed form, he's Krishna over on the left with the flute. Krishna and Vishnu are the same color, which is like a monsoon cloud, a bluish, dark bluish color. even though those statues don't exactly reflect that. Krishna is more bluish. But Vishnu is kind of like the formal presentation of God, and Krishna on the left is the familiar presentation of God. Vishnu you'd find in the palace, Krishna you'd find running around in the forest, playing with the milkmaidens and looking after the cows. So, depends what you like. Now, Vishnu, in each of his hands, he has Shankha, Chakra, Gada, Padma. He has four things in the four hands. These are universally known. And Shankha is a conch shell. And that is in his upper left hand, your upper right. Is that right, Annie? Am I seeing that correctly? And then below the conch shell, in the lower hand, you see a lotus flower dangling down. It's a lotus. Now go over to the lower hand on his right, your left, there's a club. That's his club with the big round ball at the end of it. And then go up and see his chakra. And that is his weapon. That's like a golden disc. The chakra all is constantly spinning. It doesn't stop. It's going. Right? So this is a stylized diagram of the chakra. Now, that's Vishnu above the chakra. And if you look in that picture, you see the chakra up in his upper right hand, your upper left. That's the chakra. Okay. So the chakra, if we read the bottom, it says this mantra, which is of course connected to this Sudarshan chakra. Sudarshan means darshan means a seeing or sight, and Sudarshan means everything can be seen. In other words, illumination, right? Enlightenment. This mantra is used to destroy negativity, darkness, evil, bad karma, negative planetary afflictions, enemies, and misfortune. It also confers a sense of peace and well-being and gives complete protection from all onslaughts. Well, you got it. Vishnu is God. And the Sudarshan chakra is one of his weapons used in overcoming maya or illusion, as well as material ego, demoniac forces, envious persons, destructive elements, and atheistic beliefs. Ego, E-G-O, edging God out. Go ahead.
What I read last night by the was because God is never without his feminine counterpart, she manifests herself into the chakra. So not to just look at it as a weapon that goes around and chops heads off. It's actually her energy.
God, the male aspect of God is considered to be the Shaktiman. Shakti means energy. Energy. All Shakti, all energy is feminine. And Shaktiman is the possessor or the wielder of the energy. So the male principle is the possessor or wielder or impetus behind the energy. The energy itself is the feminine manifestation, feminine principle. How can you have one without the other? You could have the male principle with and doing nothing, then there's no energy. But all the energy of the Godhead is manifest as different feminine aspects. Divine feminine. All right? Oftentimes it's said that... or has been said, if you want to win the favor of the king, you make friends with the queen. And if you make friends with the queen, then the queen will put in a good word for you with the king, and you get what you want. So, yeah, all feminine energy, feminine aspects of energy are female. Shakti is a feminine word. Shakti means energy. Okay? So, I've written the mantra as it would be properly in transliterated Sanskrit. The line below it is, it tells you how it's pronounced. So let me say it a couple times for you. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Those are all Bija mantras. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Now, you notice in the pronounce I say Sung Hung Srang. Now the G is not really pronounced. It's like a nasal. So Sung, not Sung. You don't say it like that, yeah? Om Sung Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Should I do it higher? Om Sung Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. The Phat hurls the mantra. It's almost like a spear. Like this. Phat. That throws it forward. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. 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 Now, the T on Phat, with a dot under it, is in Sanskrit what they call cerebral. So we would say phat. But correctly, it's phak. And the tongue hits the roof of the mouth. Phak. Phak. That is why the Indians did talk like that. And only the Indian is talking like this. No one else speaks like that. Right? Because they hit the roof of the mouth. Yeah.
It says the profound spot. What?
What?
It represents Pankarshan, who destroys everything at the end of the kopa. And the letter, the T at the end of the what is capable of invoking a sense of peace. So
even though you're sending it to finish it off, it goes to T. Fart. Fart. Like fart. It looks like fart. Okay. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Fart. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Phat. 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 Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hung Fat. Okay. Now, we'll go into meditation with this mantra. Of course, we will repeat it silently in meditation, individually, not together. So your meditation will proceed at your own pace or in the way you want it to, or better yet, in the way it does, rather than you control it. How, the only suggestions, would it be interesting to see this chakra in your heart, and as you say the mantra, it spreading out larger and larger and out around you in a bigger, ever widening space, you in the middle of the chakra? That's one suggestion. You want to make some? That's just a suggestion. But to envision the chakra as well, or maybe you want to get busy and use it. I don't know. So let's do that now. Close your eyes, breathe, relax, and let go deeply, deeply relax, and let go. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely. Relax, breathe, and let go. Om Sang Hung Srang Rung Hung Fat. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hong Fat. Continue. All right. Om Sang Hung Srang Rang Hong Fat. So, how was it? Any comments?
It was relaxing, although I could fall asleep at any moment now.
Tired?
No, yeah. The friends are quite relaxing and peaceful in their head today.
Well, you might work.
I'm confused with the words, but I didn't think that issue would mind that much.
Yeah, well, you can practice it. It's new, so. I invite you to work with it. And it's like anything else, it takes familiarity and practice. So we've introduced a lot of mantras here for different reasons, different purposes, different devas, different manifestations of the goddess, different manifestations of God. So you would find at least one or two that you liked. So, I invite you to work with this one. Shamanic Dream by Anugama. All right.
Thank you.
Om Tat Sat. Hare Krishna.